me tell you people, hey, revolution rising. Yeah, yeah. Proof. Yes. Watch out.
That's Mop Mop, featuring Fred Wesley on trombone and Anthony Joseph on vocals with Run Around. It's from Mop Mop's 2013 album, Isle of Magic. That trombone you must have heard, those of you who are James Brown fans. That's the trombone from James Brown's band. And Anthony Joseph is a poet and novelist and musician. He's from Trinidad, a little bias here, living in the United Kingdom at this time. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And guess what? It is Free Your Mind Friday, better than any psychotherapy session you can ever have. It is the ability to put forward your ideas and your information and your opinions for broader consideration and for debate. So you have something to offer, let's hear it. I am especially enthused about people going very, very analytical and giving us their take on things. We might have missed these things. So we depend on you in this session, which is, I think, a very important part of creating community, and especially creating community for action. We have to begin the process of talking to each other and talking out loud without the fear of somebody putting you down or retribution or, you know, any of that. The ideas, your thoughts are valid. And of course, we engage in that kind of discussion here with great respect for each other. And so in that spirit, I encourage you to call 888-874-4888. Let's hear from you what you're thinking about the issues of the week. Or you could take the conversation in an entirely different direction. It is all up to you. This is your time. Chicago, Henry, you're on the air.
Hey, Eutrice, how you doing?
Great. How are you today?
I'm doing good. I wanted to call because that interview you did with General Wesley Clark was a very eye-opening experience that I was hearing. I mean, the thing about that interview that you did with him yesterday, he didn't go around any questions. He basically told you straight up front that about the imperialist agenda going on in the Middle East. I was just basically floored because I thought he would, you know, talk like a politician and, you know, try to work his way around it, but he didn't pull any punches in that. And he just admitted it that, you know, the Americans are in the Middle East, are in Syria, you know, for imperialistic reasons. When he was talking about, when he said that he thought that it was a bad idea to go into Iraq in 2003, he didn't say, you know, he basically just said, it was bad at that time, but eventually he still wanted to go in Iraq and invade it. He just thought that, you know, they didn't have a good enough plan. Now, if they would have had a plan, he probably still would have went in there. So, and then he, well, the one thing he did started to talk about when, I guess, when you started to question him on the morality of orders in regards to, you know, invading other sovereign countries. You know, he started to use the excuse of, well, you know, I'm in the military, and in the military we take orders. We don't question if it's morality or if it's political. But then, you know, he started going on his background of, you know, having a degree in, you know, political science and military politics and business. But what he also failed to tell you and tell the audience that he is actually on the board of B&K Petroleum, which, you know, has a heavy presence, you know, and has a heavy business interest in the Middle East. And then, you know, he glossed over the fact about when you started to question him about the invasion of Iraq, and he was saying that there was a UN resolution, that was passed, you know, for this invasion. Well, you know, I looked it up, and it was Resolution 1441. It wasn't a resolution for military action. It was just a resolution saying that the Iraqis broke the law in regards to not letting UN inspectors come into the country. It didn't authorize military action. I guess I was the one that was kind of like, you know, questioning, like, okay, what UN resolution is he talking about? So it was a very eye opening interview that you had with him, and it just goes to show you that. The American forces are not there for peacekeeping. They're not there to bring stability into the region. They're in there for dominance, and that is their agenda.
And what I'm thankful that you found some value in that interview, and that is what I was hoping that people would get to understand. Now, he's speaking as a military, a former military man, still in many ways military-minded, of course. He's also the former supreme commander of NATO. So, mm-hmm. You know, it's pretty big credentials we talked with yesterday. But the thing is, the mindset that he said, and I was hoping that you would appreciate that, which was, as the military, this is how the military thinks. We get orders, and as he said yesterday, our only concern is tell us what you want, and we will tell you how to get it done and how much it will cost.
Mm-hmm.
So what I was hoping that we would get extract out of all of that, we see essentially all this distraction, you know, we talk, well the UN and Congress has made it legal, so mm-hmm. Congress has said we could do it, so it's legal, mm-hmm. and you know, shades of meaning and all of that, but you're absolutely dead on with this, that and this is what should concern our community of progressive people and people who are fed up of this kind of thinking, because, as I said yesterday, there are no clean hands here. And
no.
He chuckled a little bit when I said it's you know, the African proverb, when the elephants fight, it's the grass that loses.
Mm-hmm.
And they're finding more and more countries, the West and the East, they're finding more and more countries to play out their lethal games in, and it's something that we ought to understand. But not just to say no to war, but to understand what is driving the thinking here. And I'm glad that you got something out of that interview.
And you know what? And here, the one last thing I want to do is make connection to between this international and domestic, and it basically ties into the interview. This guy is a military man. Now, obviously, the military is the arm of the United States outside of, you know, the country. And the thing about it is that its sole mission is to preserve the system outside of the United States and around the globe. You look at police in the rural areas. Their mission is to not protect and serve. Their mission is to protect the system and to protect its interests in regards to property and whatever it needs to do. It doesn't care about the people. And just like with the military doesn't care about anybody outside of, you know, of the arm of the system. It just cares about dominating and like I said, to protect the system and its interests. So we have to make this connection of, you know, what the military does and what the police is doing. I mean, what he just basically described is basically police brutality on an international level, which is what's happening here in the United States.
But he also, I give him credit for being, as you noted, I give him credit for being as forthright as possible. He wasn't 100% forthright.
He was bluntly honest.
In the scheme of things, we have to say that he didn't dodge too many questions yesterday. Thank you so much, Henry, for your call. And I'm glad you found something of value in that interview. Let's go to New York. Joel, you're on the air.
Hello, Utrice.
How are you today?
I'm very fine, thank you. By the way, I wanted to commend you on your program yesterday, which I was lucky to catch. And also the program earlier in the week, which had the historian Walter Johnson on, where he exposed the political economy of racism in Ferguson, a very important program. So I thought both of them were excellent. You're welcome. And, very briefly, because I really don't want to talk about General Walker. But I think one of the values of the program yesterday was that it exposed what is in fact the liberal interventionist point of view. The general is really a Clintonista. He's been part of the Clintonista camp for a long time. And what we heard was really her position on the long war, the long Middle Eastern war that has been going on since 1991. I defy anybody to tell me the difference between what we heard yesterday and the neoconservative point of view, because that's the influence over Obama right now, the neoconservatives in the State Department, the Defense Department, who sort of have his ear. I don't think there's any difference. And one last thing. If you think about the debate, so-called debate that we had to endure 3 or 4 days ago, every one of those knuckleheads, including the great socialist humanitarian, would subscribe to the point of view that the general enunciated yesterday. But I didn't want to really talk about that. I just thought I would mention that. I thought they were great programs, and I commend you for them. I wanted to talk about something else that has been in the news significantly over the week, and that is what has happened in Israel. And I wanted to specifically talk about Israel, the media, and the way in which the relationship between Israel and mostly the American media suggests something of an anatomy of the sick society. And I'm thinking specifically, maybe you saw it, and maybe some of the listeners saw it, of a video that is all over the place now of a 13-year-old Palestinian kid named Ahmed Manasra bleeding to death on a pavement of an East Jerusalem neighborhood. The video shows the callous verbal abuse and insults from Israelis watching this child writhe in agony. We hear such comments as, "Die, you son of a whore, die, die," and things that are even more heartless. And all of this has gone viral on social media. And while there's been much discussion of this video and other similar incidents involving extrajudicial executions of Palestinian youths accused by Israelis by Israel of having stabbed Israelis, there is decidedly little examination of the social implications of all of this. And specifically, it's become taboo to interrogate just what sort of ideological and psychological conclusions can be drawn about Israeli society, a society where such behavior is not an outlier, where rather than being an anomaly, it seems to be indicative of a significant, if not mainstream, attitude in the culture. And such undeniably barbaric treatment is not simple hate and can't be explained away or justified. But that is precisely what the corporate media does. And there are many political analysts and activists and others who are timid about outright condemnations of Israeli society and Israeli attitudes. And with much justification, they're fearful of being demonized as anti-Semitic, terrified that rather than open dialogue or critical examination, they'll have their arguments twisted and portrayed as racist. And, you know, these accusations are warranted sometimes, as in the case of, you know, fascists and neo-Nazis for whom the word Jew is synonymous with evil. But more often than not, they are willfully deceptive deflections that are designed to shield Israeli society from the criticism that it so clearly deserves. But, you know, it seems to me that those whose interest is in justice and speaking the truth can't be silent. They cannot allow themselves to become the victims of self-censorship induced by fear, because muted criticism of Israel is in fact a failure to properly defend oppressed people. It is an abdication of the responsibility to speak against injustice, the brutality of colonialism, because that's what this situation is. It is not a conflict between two parties to resolve a near intractable problem of two people wanting the same land. It is an example of colonialism.
What do you make of the silence as well in the media of the opposition to this kind of behavior inside of Israel? The movement against this violence, the opposition to the Netanyahu regime. We don't hear, or we wouldn't think, that there is, in fact, a very vibrant and active resistance going on in Israel among Jews.
And in this country as well. But of course, the resistance is different here than it is there. The reason why the media, do you mean the media of the United States? The media in Europe is very different, by the way. The English media, the British media, is very close to the American media in terms of giving a distorted or diluted account of the events that are happening, both in the short view and the long view. But much of the European media is very, very different about this. So I think we have to ask ourselves, why is it that the American media acts this way? And by the way, it does another thing as well. What it does is it tries to go out of its way to say that it is being fair and transparent, you know, by presenting the issue as if it's an issue of a balanced reporting. In reality, of course, it obscures the true nature of the conflict, one between the colonial oppressor and the victim. So why does it do it? It does it because it's an appendage of government. Because of the, and we've talked about this again and again on this program. You've had programs about this. You've alluded to it indirectly and directly. One of the many, many crises that we have in this country is that we no longer really have a disinterested media, which is an absolute essential in a pluralist democracy. Instead, we have ludicrously servile, compliant supplicants who are appendages of power. And in any really open society, the media has to stand away from power and monitor power. And when necessary, like somebody like Thomas Paine, challenge power. But they're not going to do that. And as a result, you're never going to see any kind of real substantive criticism of the Israeli state, or really of Zionism, or the pathology of Israeli fascism.
Thank you, Gerald. Thanks so much. You can wrap up.
Sure. So the last thing I wanted to say is that when you get this kind of rhetoric, what it does is it obscures what the real problem is. And the real problem is the problem of ethnic cleansing, both as a concept, a Zionist concept, and as a military objective of the, you know, present government in Israel. And it has become the political currency of modern Israel. And that's one of the reasons why we have to support all of those in Israel and all of those in the West Bank and Gaza, Palestinians and Israelis alike, who are struggling to get their self-determination. And it's really it's the self-determination of Israelis that suffer just as much as Palestinians when you have this tyranny that's imposed upon this culture. And we in the United States can help by not buying Israeli goods and supporting the boycott, divestment, and sanction program, which is sweeping the world and has the Israeli authorities really worried. And we should support that. That's, you know, we can at least do that.
Thank you so much for your call today and your contribution. From Massachusetts, Zahira, you're on the air.
Please. I just want to, you know, thank you for this program that you are, that you have. I'm going to be quick. I have a little bit of dementia, and I don't want to, you know, take it away from the topic that you're on, but I've been wanting to call and talk about this issue. I just got the courage to do it. And it's about, you know, genocide and, you know, that we are, you know, we are at war. You know that we're at war, but we can't fight if we're sick. We can't fight if we're sick. And what happened to me was that I had a needle biopsy in a major hospital. I was healthy. I walked in. They bled me. As a result, my pulse went down to 2 beats a minute. I ended up with, you know, damage of all my organs. But through time, through exercise, through food, I was able to, if not heal, I did heal, but to stabilize that diseases such as diabetes, lupus, glaucoma, asthma. I had 3 kinds of dementia. I was diagnosed with severe dementia, cognitive memory impairment, and clinical depression about 3 years ago. If you asked me my name, I couldn't even tell you my name. You know, now I'm back to work, and it's like we don't have to be as sick as we are. You know, our men and women, you know, 30 years old, they're sick with, oh my God, high blood pressure, diabetes, you know, and like people look at these diseases as, oh, well, you know, it's nothing because everybody has them. But it's sort of like a genocide. And I just wanted to say that we don't have to be sick. There are herbal doctors. There are, I mean, through just food and exercise. You have Gary Null, you know, Dr. Savy, you know, these kind of people might look at them as quacks, but just for me, just listening on the radio to Gary, you know, listening to Dr. Sabies and, you know, other just on YouTube, I was able to stabilize a lot of these ailments that I had.
Well, I take your point very clearly because I too believe that, you know, the health is number one. You really need to, you know, put yourself for many people, you know, this is like, oh my gosh, there are so many other people to take care of. I don't have time to take care of myself. But your point is well taken. It's time. It's always time to take care of yourself and your health, because as Ahira was pointing out, to do anything, you have to be around to do it. So it makes sense. Thanks, Zahira, for your call today.
Thank you.
New York, Patricia, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Nutrice, and good afternoon
Hello.
To the PRN family.
Thank you.
As I watched that debate the other night, the first thing that struck me, which was almost identical to the Republican audience, was that there were few people of color in the audience. And so, again, I was reminded that it really makes absolutely no difference whether you profess to be a Democrat or you profess to be a Republican. Our agenda and our issues are not on the table. We're not even a thought, except, of course, now we're being prostituted because everybody wants to get on the Black Lives Matter bandwagon, and so, you know, everybody has to have a position on racial justice. And so I'm listening to the question posed by Anderson Cooper the other night to Hillary Clinton about whether, you know, she changes her position depending upon how the wind is blowing. And I heard her talk about criminal justice reform as if she and Bill had absolutely nothing to do with it. It was as if they were disconnected from this and they were going to now solve a problem that they didn't know how it came to being. All of a sudden now, everybody wants to make certain that sentences are fair and that they don't destroy individuals and families and communities. And I want to say, really? Gee, Thanks a lot. Now that the damage has been done, now that you've destroyed people's lives and families' lives and destroyed communities, now you want to say, well, maybe we need to fix this? And my, you know, as I said to you before, I'm done. I'm done. I'm sitting this one out. I'm under no illusions. You know, as I said to you before, the only reason I would go to the polls was if I was going to pull the lever for Bernie Sanders so I could stick it to Hillary. Remember that comment?
Correct, I do.
But, you know, I now realize that I don't even believe Bernie Sanders is winning to win, is running to win. I believe he's running to push Hillary in the direction that he wants her to go. Because there is absolutely no issue that was on the table that pertained to me. And so as they run into South Carolina, you know, Hillary, you know, all the pundits are saying that Hillary doesn't need to be concerned because she's got the African-American vote locked up. South Carolina is going to be the first state, and that's going to be the test ground for Sanders in terms of his support of African-Americans, which everybody is saying is not there. I don't care. Because in the final analysis, you know, I listened to Obama talk yesterday when he was talking about the fact that troops were going to remain in Afghanistan. And I listened to him when he spoke at the UN a few weeks ago. At the UN, he talked about preserving humanity. And yesterday he talked about, you know, making certain that children could go to school and protection of the people in the region, in Syria. And I wanted to say, wait a minute, you can't protect me. You couldn't protect 12-year-old Tamir Rice. Schools are being closed under your administration. Our kids can't get a decent education. What are you talking about? And so it is my hope that as the primaries move into these states with large, you know, percentages of African Americans, that they begin to think about what they're hearing and what they're seeing.
But what they're hearing and what they're seeing very often, Patricia, is coming from their leadership. And their leadership is seeing it exactly the way Obama sees it, exactly the way Hillary Clinton sees it, even the way Bernie Sanders sees it. Their leadership has been telling them and is again telling them that the Democratic Party is your saving grace.
Well, I hope that if anyone who looked in that room the other night, that their lying eyes will convince them that they didn't see what they saw. Nobody in that room. Yeah, I saw Jesse stand up.
That was Jesse. He was a stand-in.
Yeah, I saw him stand up. And there were a couple of speckles in the room. But as you pan that room, was the common man there? The common person that looks like you and me, were we there? I don't think so. So people need to go beyond what their leadership is telling them. You know that old saying, the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. Mm-hmm. The problem with African Americans is that they have no sense of history, not past history, but just recent history, like 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 20 years ago. Their memories are short. And somehow we have to educate them so that their memories are not so short.
Well, thank you. A great lesson today from you today, Patricia. Thank you so much for that. Well, let's go to South Carolina, the first state that will be voting as Patricia just says. What are those, the make or break states for Hillary?
Khalil, you're on the air.
Hi, Utrees. I'm so enthralled to speak with you today.
Thank you.
Oh, my goodness, there's gunshots down the street. Wow. Okay. Anyway, you know, you sound great, and I really hope you're not suffering, and I hope you're doing as well as you sound. And
thank you. I am.
Belabor the point, because the last lady was right. These whole treatment things are a scam, and you have to go with new information, maybe. Anyway, your comment a little bit earlier when you had a caller talking about the issues in Israel today and yesterday and the day before, it's distressing because I do remember in Democracy Now! A few months ago they had two pilots, which is pretty upper echelon in Israel, two Israeli pilots, a male and a female. And they spoke out and they told the truth about what's going on with the genocide. in Israel. And to speak of this in this country, automatically many times you're labeled as anti-Semitic, when in fact we don't hear the dissenting voices, as you said. If you have to read, you have to do some work. You have to do the research and read, like, Al-Haaretz, or you have to read the Israeli papers online. And you find that many, maybe 40% of the Israelis don't agree with those policies, but it's just the power elite, just like we have in this country, the power elite, that does not necessarily do what we would like. And I think folks need to do the research before they jump to conclusions, because, you know, I grew up in Philly, right? And I've lived in Dutchess County, New York, and now I'm in South Carolina. And I spent many, many years around Hasidic Jews and Arabs and Muslims. And I think it's terrible the way folks have labeled Muslims. I mean, look at where I'm living now. These are troglodytes, a lot of these people around here. They really don't have a clue. Because when you're at a university, you're around Muslims all the time. And many times they're the most peaceful people in the neighborhood. And even NOI Muslims, you know, folks who converted when they were in prison, they come out, they have a whole different mindset. You know, I'd much rather be around some of those folks than others. And unless you've experienced it, you may not understand what I've been saying. But back to the Israel thing, a lot of folks don't understand, and you get good guess, and that's the other thing I wanted to say. Number one, you're so well-rounded. Your musical selections, you go from bop to straight ahead to dub to roots and culture, and then when you played Thievery Corporation the other day, that was it. I was just like, oh, man. But anyway, you know, a lot of folks don't understand unless you are with the scholars that study these things. Like, our foreign aid to Israel is mostly weaponry, and there's a scam that's going on. I'll call it a scam because I think it's a scam. So our defense contractors give Israel weapons, and, you know, disguised as foreign aid, or that's how it's labeled. And they use them on the Palestinians when they feel like it, because we can't test it on human beings here. Right. So they take all the statistics, they figure out how accurate it is, this and that. And I'm not making this up. There's authors, I think Dr. Peter Dale Scott, a professor emeritus, he will testify to that. He's written about it. Other folks. But that's serious. You know, that I think that's really objectionable.
So let me ask you, Khalil. Mm-hmm. You obviously are a person who has done what you advise the rest of us to do, which is to do some research. What do you then do with this information once you have it? How does it change what you do and how you operate?
Well, what it does is how I operate. Okay. First of all, you can't bring this topic up with everyone. You have to, if you want to spread the word or encourage people to do the most important thing. And we've talked before, and I have to hammer this home. The most important thing is to encourage people to do the research, because what happens now, where we are now, is people have been dumbed down so much. People are so ignorant, and they're so ignorant till they don't know they're ignorant. And here in South Carolina, these folks, they wake up and they slather ignorance upon their body like it's night cream before they go to bed. Because if you do the research, you will be very upset.
But then, you know, not to make a judgment necessarily, because this is how systems work. Systems work, especially systems of power, work to dumb down the population. This has been the root cause and the root motivation for alternative media, that the mainstream media, that's their job. That's what they do. We've been talking about it in the context of the most recent Q&A sessions, as I call them, these so-called debates, where on the one hand, you're thinking this is about elevating your knowledge of the democratic process and the electoral process, when it's just about money and it's about influence and it's about who gets what for, you know, it's a whole different agenda playing out before our eyes, and yet it is fashioned to make us believe that something else is happening. So ignorance, and we're all ignorant, because our views, for the most part, unless we really, really invest heavily in searching out the truth, we are all ignorant. And it's a constant battle every day to guard against the infiltration of these rotten ideas into our heads, these falsehoods, these distractions, to give us a sense that our reality is different from what we know it to be. So I just wanted to say that in defense of the ignorance you see as being so pervasive.
May I say this also? I would like to say, as you were, as I was listening to you, when I say ignorance, unfortunately, has gotten a negative connotation over the past, 50, 60 years. I don't mean that in a negative way, because folks are ignorant, not of their own volition. It's just that the public schools have been defunded for years. I remember when they stopped gym in the mid-70s, and I went to a good public school, and I remember that next semester or whatever, the school year, we didn't have physical education anymore. Then the arts go. Then the civics. See, that's the key. The folks don't get civics anymore. They don't even understand that the country can run without a president. It's mostly, it's the grassroots. So you ask me, what do I do? Yes, we have to emulate what the Tea Party did and start. You have to start local. That's what they did. See, if you pack these state houses, And then pack your state senates. They have a lot of power. Then they lean that they decide who goes where. So we have to, folks, you have to start local. That's why people are disenchanted with voting, and I understand that. So you have to take your energy, and you have to. I work with groups here. This is what I have to do because this place is so stinky. I'm telling you, it is so stinky. It's nothing like the Hudson Valley. But, yes, we have to start local.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your contribution today, Khalil. Great to hear from you today, too. Thanks. From Dallas, Sarah, you're on the air.
Greetings to you, Utrecht.
Thank you. And to you, too.
Yes, and of course to the PRN audience, as well as all of the first-time callers that I'm hearing.
Thank you.
So yes, ma'am, that is good news to hear that if the word is spreading far and wide and you're getting new listenership. But,
great.
Yes, ma'am. You are so welcome. But, Utrecht, what I wanted to thank you for is I'm glad that you had General Wesley Clark on yesterday. I didn't get to hear all of the interview because I was in and out. So what I'm going to have to do is sit back and re-listen to it and get my notes out because as I sent you that clip I sent you a few days ago, he was my commander when I was in Europe. He was, as I said, he was the Supreme Allied Commander stationed out in Sheik, Belgium. And I guess it must have been karma or something, Utrecht, that all of these individuals, I happened to work with them at one time or the other in my career in the military, General Powell as well as General Clark. So I don't know what the universe is telling me, but as the previous call. Yes, fortunate or unfortunately, I did work for both of them. So that could not be a good thing. But to address a couple of the concerns that a caller has, yes, when you're in the military, you basically are working as an agent because, as the Constitution stated, no standing army is allowed within the United States. And the military has worked primarily outside of the United States. It's the enforcement arm that is used for these corporations. And what you're basically doing, you're working as mercenaries to secure the resources for these corporate entities. That's basically what it is in a nutshell. And you're out there, you secure the thing. That's why all of this stuff that's going on, that's why everywhere you find a military station, they're stationed at strategic points within which to control those resources that the United States and our other multinational corporations have their hands on, and that's where they want you there. You're going to go in there, you're going to secure the objectives, and you're going to prevent others from coming back in and reclaiming what is rightfully theirs. But I'm digressing slightly, and Patricia touched on something that she said with this debate. I did not even bother to look at the Utrecht because I know it was going to be some of the same fluff. And to quote a couple of these, like with Glenn Ford and a few others that's on this network with Bruce Dixon, has stated with Bernie Sanders is like a sheepdog. And we all know what sheepdogs are used to do in order within which to get the herd going in a certain direction. And that's what Bernie Sanders is primarily here for. Because if he was really a social democrat and independent, as he claimed to be, he would know he would not be caucusing or he would not be running with the Democrats in this primary trying to get himself into the White House. He would have stand out by himself and say, I'm an independent, I'm going to stay independent, and I'm going to work it on at least establish an independent party. But that's not what he's doing. He's out there, and he's going to push Hillary, or maybe they've all already colluded to say, okay, you know what, we're going to have you in here to play the good cop, bad cop, because you're going to push her in the direction that she needs to go in, and that way it's going to help secure him. And then at the same time, Bernie is bringing in all of these disillusioned Democrats, progressives, liberals, whatever names they are going by now, who have become disaffected from the last two presidential elections. And he's going to draw them back in, you know, pull them back in because they've been sitting out on the fringes. Now they're going to come back in because they see Bernie looks very promising. So now we're going to get him back in, and they're going to put them all back into the big Democratic tent, and they're going to be one big happy family again. But as Patricia said, Utrice, I'm done. I'm not voting. The best thing that we can do in this system is to be non-participants. This system is predicated upon you going out here and pulling a lever because theoretically, you don't even elect none of these people. It's these people with electronic voting are already here and with money because the money people who fund these people's campaign, they've already bought and paid for them. All they want you to do now is for you to go out here and pick your favorite and pull a lever to make it look legit that they have actually been voted into office. But you're not doing anything because electronic voting have already pretty much taken it over. So if people would be non-participants, do not vote, sit out, let me see, and you would really and truly see what that these people, they would really see, you know, it would bring a shock to their system because now they can't pull off this heist. Because in order for them to get elected, somebody got to go to that poll and pull that lever to make it look legit. So if you don't participate, there's no one pulling the lever. You can't all of a sudden say, okay, well, I got 25,000 votes because nobody voted.
I'm interested. I get your point. I want to return to a point you made earlier, and I have to ask you about it, and that is the ideological framework for Bernie Sanders here and what you suspect is the game that is being played. What signal has he given, in your view, that he is, in fact, a stalking horse for Hillary Clinton?
The way I'm just looking at the song bites and the things that he has said, he has really not put forth any effort because if you check his voting records, going from way back when, from when he was in the Congress to now he's in the Senate, you would still see that he still votes. He is still pro-military, pro-big government, even though he says that he is not. His records are there for everyone to view. And everything that Hillary Clinton is trying to say now, you know, now all of a sudden now she is just throwing up any and everything out in here within which to try and make herself a viable candidate. But it's already already out there in black and white, in sound bites, on video, as well as in written form, for you to see where Hillary Clinton stands. And Bernie Sanders is just doing the same thing. He's just coming along here, just showing, just like Barack Obama did. Oh, well, you know, when I'm the new sheriff in town, and I'm going to clean things up, and I'm going to bring the change that you can see, and all this other blah, 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 just to get you all enthused again. And you run out there, and then, you know, first day in office, what does he do? He starts the drone striking campaign in Pakistan. Bernie Sanders is going to do the same thing because these people do not control the United States. They're a figurehead, as we've been saying over and over again. The shadow government, that's been in operation probably ever since FDR, that has always run this country. These people don't run nothing.
Okay. Well, we'll take a look. Of course, we are going to be talking about Bernie and you know, nice and personal, very close up and personal, and we'll get to know him a little bit better. Right now, you know, it's just a warm-up, although the media is doing its best to let us believe that, oh, the campaign is in full swing. No, 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 it isn't. It's just, no,
they haven't done it.
They're trying to figure out who is going to be standing as of next year. So this is where we are. Thanks so much for your call. Always a pleasure hearing from you. From Brooklyn, Pat, you're on the air.
How you doing, Mrs. You, Chief?
Fine, thank you. How about you?
I'm fine myself. Yourself. I just want to say this.
Are you sure it's yourself or myself? Which one is it?
Yeah. Well, I'm fine as well. Your forecasting of this Q&A, which was perpetrated as a debate, forecasted. Right. You forecasted. I know you're not Miss Cleo, but if you could get me 6 of those lottery numbers, that'll be good. But on a more serious note, I want to follow up on Sister Sarah. If it was a true debate and Bernie Sanders really wanted to be an independent, he had plenty of arsenal. He had plenty of arsenal to call Sister Billary on all of those things that her husband did while he was in office. When you talk about justice and reform, you got to remember it was Bill Clinton who signed those bills in, the 3 strikes. It was Bill Clinton who incarcerated all those black and brown men. It was Bill Clinton. Hillary was right there by his side. Bernie Sanders had plenty of arsenal. It was Bill Clinton who signed in NAFTA. Now she's going backwards on the transatlantic trade. He had plenty of arsenal. He really wanted to be independent.
Yeah. And, but look, as far as... But to be fair, Pat, here's the thing. If you were a candidate, if you were candidate Sanders, you know Hillary Clinton is the only female in the Democratic lineup so far. You don't want to take a chance of attacking a woman because that's not going to be good for you. So you mind your P's and Q's. And besides which, you have a great defense right off the bat. And that is Bill Clinton isn't running. Hillary is running, and they're 2 different people. What do you say to that?
I think they're the Gemini twins. You know, on a personal level, but I guess from a strategic point, if he doesn't want to come off on that could be why he played it safe. You know, he stayed on the safe ground. Okay, you know, if that's the case, I'm running independent of my husband. Yeah, right. That's like Obama ran independent of the Clintons. You know, that's the same, if you ask me, you know, that'd be the same argument, but you'll get the same thing. You go in there with the same script, then you must be running for the same people. With that said, the other thing is that I just want to call you on this, but you did make a correction when you said high school debate. I was a high school debater, and that was nowhere near.
Now, I said it actually insults high school debates. High school debates are a much higher caliber than what we've been witnessing.
I'm glad you corrected yourself, but when you said that initially, I was like, what? No, definitely. There was no high school debating. That was nothing but more than a kumbaya and everybody holds hands and kiss and hug. There was nothing that replicated debate. But once again, it's all been said that the powers to be had wrestled that away from the League of Women Voters, and the League of Women Voters didn't want to perpetrate any fraud. And what we've been having for the last couple of years are frauds. And this shows, if nobody ever saw it, this clearly was an indication of fraud being perpetrated. And where I come from, on the street level, we call it perpetrating a frenzy. That was perpetrating a frenzy.
Even drag Snoop into this. A frizzy.
Thank you, Chief, and continue the good work.
Thank you, Pat. Great call today. Let's go to Berkeley and talk to Harvey.
Hello, wonderful, Chief.
Hello, wonderful, Harvey. How are you doing today?
Very good. I'd like to talk about gun control. Seems to be on everybody's mind. I'm looking at a headline here in yesterday's San Francisco Chronicle. It says, toddlers are shooting people on a weekly basis. It tells the story of a 2-year-old in Southern Carolina found a gun in the back seat of a car. He was riding and accidentally shot grandma through the back there in the passenger seat. Well, it's more than just that. It turns out that Hillary, during the debate, said that about 90 people get gunned down every day in America, and that's a big number there. And it turns out that if you're looking at numbers, you know, the gun industry is the poster child for privatizing profit and socializing the loss. And if you go to Google and put in the words $229 billion total annual cost of gun violence, every year, $229 billion. And it's what it is that a lot of people who get shot don't have insurance. They go to emergency room, incredible cost. Then they go on disability benefits. There's a loss of income, family support. I mean, we're talking mega bucks here. And it turns out that gun violence in America costs the average American, or costs every American, $700 a year. $700, when you're working, you know, you're earning $700 and you give it over in taxes, well, that $700 goes towards gun violence, because that's what's happening here. So I think that the taxpayers shouldn't have to pick up the bill, just like car insurance. If we had to pay for all the accidental deaths and injury in cars, I mean, be trillions. And it's the same with guns. We're paying there. $700 per person, it's costing us. So everybody's affected here. It's not just, oh, I'm safe. No. $700 goes out of your pocket if you pay taxes towards this. So I'm calling for gun insurance. And also, Dr. Gary, another reason is Dr. Gary Noel told us that a lot of the mass shooting, the people who do the shooting, are on psychiatric drugs of some sort, some industrial, pharmaceutical, psychiatric drugs. So this, by insurance, hopefully would weed these people out, and we'd have less psychotic people on the street with guns. And so it really is a time to call for gun insurance, and that's what I'm calling about.
Okay, so how, in your view, would this gun insurance work? I mean, what would be the mechanism here that would create, for example, more responsible use, if you will, of
yes.
guns? Or should I ask whether you favor gun ownership, or you're not in favor of it?
I think that gun ownership is inevitable, but I think that it should be controlled like cars. You know, if we just let people go without rules, you know, we just drive into everything, it would be unmanageable if we didn't have... So I think that, for instance, it says gun shop to pay $5.73 million to injured policemen. Turns out that the gun shop sold a gun to somebody who was crazy, and then they shot the policeman, and so they didn't really do a good check. I think insurance would take care of that. I think insurance, because death and destruction, that's their meat and potatoes. They know death and destruction, and I think they will set up mandatory tests for people who own guns, so that they weed out all the people who are pathogenic in nature and would use guns, and there would be laws against those people who are walking around with illegal guns. So I think it's time for us to secure our streets, in a sense, because when you have headlines like toddlers are shooting people on a weekly basis, I think we've gone over the top here. And it's an insecure environment, and I think gun insurance would do a lot toward making us more secure and safer. We're all affected here, including out of our wallets. $700 a year, each of us are paying for this.
But so, let me ask you, on a parallel track, we have a little time that you could answer. Let's take the parallel example of cigarette use. Cigarette use is also dangerous, and it causes cancer, and it causes massive expense to take care of people who develop lung cancer and emphysema and all these other various diseases as a result of cigarette use. Would you, if you are promoting gun insurance, should we now consider cigarette insurance?
Here's my answer. My answer is, right now we don't have single-payer insurance like every other industrialized nation. This puts us behind the eight ball. And if we had single-payer, which comes out of the, which is run by the government, to give us all health insurance, all of us, every one of us is covered, and they take instead of the, you know, they give the business, they take it away from the insurance companies and give it to the government, and then they give them gun insurance instead as a compensation for taking away single payer. So this way, you know, once we have gun insurance, it'll help to reduce the violence out there. And once we have single payer, everyone who is sick will have coverage for any one of the cigarette liability as well as gun violence. And I think that's the way to go. Yeah.
Well, you're elected.
Thank you.
We vote for you.
Thanks, I love
Harvey, for your call. Thank you all for your calls today. Great, great thoughts and opinions. I really relish this time that we have together where we can throw ideas around. And as you can tell, we have very profound ideas in play on this program. And I thank you for that. And I thank you also for maintaining a consistently high standard of discussion. Stay tuned. Coming up next, more great programming right here on PRN.FM. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. And I want to tell you, this weekend, if you haven't done it yet, make it a law in your life. Absolutely nobody who is negative should be around you at all. Just drive that kind of influence out of your life. You'll be happier and you'll be healthier. Thank you so much. Always a pleasure and a great, great, great privilege from me to you to be in your company. I thank you so much for that. And we'll join each other on Monday. Bye-bye. They're giving us the run around. Oh, yeah. We're giving us the run around.